Tune to the Truth Channel, truthnews.com.au, where we give you nothing but the facts, plus a little commentary, plus a little spin. But we give you commentary and spin based on our best estimate of what actually is true, which of course may be false. But we admit it, so we hope you'll give us the benefit of the doubt. It's the 25th of August, 2010, and my name's Hereward Fenton, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so. We have John Bursell, a prominent 9/11 truther and well-known to many of our listeners, founder of... sort of co-founder of the 9/11 Truth Movement here in Sydney. Back in 2007, John and I started getting out on the street talking about information that had been suppressed in the news. And we found as soon as we started doing that, that there were a lot more people, a hell of a lot more people out there who were already thinking along the same lines. And of course, this is all part of a much larger movement. The 9/11 movement's global. And the 9/11 questions really touch on every aspect of what is kind of wrong with the world. It gives a window on the power structures that have got completely out of control and led to gross abuses of human rights, wars, unparalleled destruction of sovereign nations in the name of a false kind of symbol, a complete inversion, in fact, of truth and morality, because these wars that have been conducted in the name of 9/11, in the wake of 9/11, are not about freedom, they're not about democracy. And yet that's what is continually championed, that's what we hear about on the news all the time. So I have John Bursell coming on, and he's going to be talking about the upcoming September 11 anniversary coming up in a few weeks' time. And he'll also be bringing some other news that he would like to share with us. And for the next few minutes, I'm going to go through some of the other headlines from this week's Twitter stream. US recession deepens as home sales fall and foreclosures rise. This is quite an alarming set of statistics coming from the United States, where despite the constant news bombardment that that the recession is over, the actual reality on the ground is quite different. Over a year ago, U.S. President Barack Obama implemented the Home Affordable Modification Program, which was designed to help unemployed homeowners avoid foreclosures by allowing the banks to lower interest rates and mortgages. Reports show that the program has not quite succeeded. According to RealityTrack, nearly 300,000 homes have been foreclosed upon and only about 30,000 have received aid from the HAMP program. Economist Max Frad Wolf from the New School in New York said the program has failed because it is the wrong program and it is merely a band-aid on a bullet wound. So the situation in America is quite extreme, and the fact that the economy is continuing to deteriorate and collapse there is a sign to me that we can expect more of the same around the world very soon. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, I wasn't planning to play a sting there so quickly, but anyway, that sounded okay. Let's continue. Next story, Steve Jobs is watching you. Yes, Apple is seeking to patent spyware. It looks like Apple Inc. is exploring a new business opportunity, spyware, and what we're calling traitorware. This is from an article from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a freedom and civil rights organization based in America. While users were celebrating the new jailbreaking and unlocking exemptions, Apple was quietly preparing to apply for a patent on technology that, among other things, would allow Apple to identify and punish users who take advantage of those exemptions or otherwise tinker with their devices. The patent application does nothing short of providing a roadmap to how Apple can and presumably will spy on its customers and control the way its customers use Apple products. As Sony BMG learned, spying on your customers is bad for business, and the kind of spying enabled here is especially creepy. It's not just spyware, it's traitorware, since it is designed to allow Apple to retaliate against you if you do something Apple doesn't like. Now, let me just go through what the technology here that they've built in to the iPhones can do. It can spy on you. It can take photographs of you. It will obviously geolocate where it is, and it can record you. And I'm just going to actually scroll down here in the article. It can even detect and record the heartbeat of the device's user. Once an unauthorized user is identified, Apple could wipe the device and remotely store the user's sensitive data. Now, there might be some reasons why, as a customer, you might want to utilize that service, if it was simply a service that you were going to pay for. But this is not the way it works. This is actually going to be a feature that is built in to the hardware, and it can even be used for Apple to spy on you in case you breach some terms of purportedly of your agreement with them. And it could even come down to, as they've said there, you know, hacking the system to make it do things that it wouldn't normally be able to do, or perhaps if you breach some copyright arrangements. So what we're talking about here is a device that is centrally controlled, that can basically, and you know, advertises now the fact that it can basically watch your every move and feed that back to a central data store. And you have really no control over what it does. Quite an alarming story, I found. Okay, we are going to have to break now. I wanted to get through some more stories, but time will not allow it. I'm about to break to bring on our guest for the night, John Bursell. Please stand by. And welcome to Truth News Radio, John Bursell.
G'day, Harewood. How are you going? Good to see you've still got the podcast running, and good to be back on the show.
Yeah, I've managed to continue to do the show once a week for quite a while now. It does get a little smoother over time, I found. We basically acquire the skills that we need to do this sort of thing as we go. And you've actually done the same. You've had your show, your podcast going. You haven't done a show for a while now, but you had quite a few excellent shows which I actually would like to rebroadcast at some point, one of your most recent one that you did with Robert Bowman, which I think was really, really excellent.
Yeah, no, it's been great, and there will be more shows coming soon. Not sure what format they'll be out of, but pretty sure they'll be coming back out of Visibility 9/11 soon. Yeah, Michael Woolsey, the producer of the shows, they've just got remarried and has been on his honeymoon and, you know, just sort of taking some time out. So hopefully we'll get him fired up again soon and we'll get back into it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, John, you're obviously, you know, one of the more sort of, you've got your feet on the ground and you've really got a grip on what's important and what's not in terms of information about questions about 9/11. And I thought that when you interviewed Robert Bowman, the two of you together, it made a really good listen, because you basically were stripping away things that don't matter. And one part of it, and that's really important, I think, of what we do, because people get very worked up about when they discover that 9/11 was an inside job. They get very worked up about it, and they want to bring in all the stuff that they've done, all the research that they've done, all the ideas that they've got, and they do it with the best of intentions, right? But what actually happens when people do that is they end up sounding a little bit crazy, and what you guys did, and you know what the better people do in this movement is they sort of try to just strip it all back again, down to the really key things. And you know, I just thought that one of the things that Robert Bowman said that I really liked was that it's not our job in the truth movement to explain every detail of what happened in terms of a conspiracy, because we obviously can't know. I mean, there's so much information that's hidden from us. We're able to identify inconsistencies and errors and lies because we can see when, for example, a politician or an official contradicts themselves, and we can point that out. Well, this person contradicted themselves, or this evidence contradicts the laws of physics. You know, we can point things like that out, which are simple observations. Then we take that information and we say, well, this is why there must be a new inquiry.
Yeah, well, we provide a picture, you know, in a context of the situation, you know, and that's what we've got to do as activists when we're talking to individuals. You know, we need to create a picture of what we see, but we can't make it too, you know, too deep or too intimidating initially, obviously. You know, it just doesn't work. So, like, I just wrote this latest piece yesterday that you'll probably have up on 9/11 Oz by the time this goes up, about the idea of 9/11 Truth for Peace, and happens to be that you're organising this anniversary 9/11 Truth for Peace activity on September 11, which will be a really good thing. Just got me thinking about the reasons why we do 9/11 Truth, and can it really bring peace? And when you work your way through all the issues and all the evidence just around the official story, you know, there's just nothing there. And it's just so obvious to people when they just look at that, well, if that's not what happened, then what did happen? And then their minds are open to other ideas. But obviously this very hard, uncontested scientific evidence of Building 7 and free fall and nanothermite really seems to be very strong with the technical people that aren't so worried about the geopolitical, deep politics, shadow government side of things, you know. They get a handle on it. But then, you know, the left-wing journalists or the people that might be interested in what we're doing, just so they know, you know, they don't, the science doesn't really do it for them necessarily. It gets them interested, but they want to be able to believe that, you know, there's elements within governments that are competent enough to do 9/11, that are organized enough, that can really, you know, could get away with it. The thing they don't realize is how powerful an event like that is in sort of creating its own censorship and creating silence. You know, it's such a shocking event. It's like, you know, dad raped the daughter, you know, in a household. That's sort of how it is, you know. It's a pretty big deal, you know.
Yeah, it's extremely big. And I think a lot of journalists, they want to have something like the Pentagon Papers, you know, or something like what WikiLeaks has done, you know, documents that are acknowledged, that are leaked, that sort of are uncontested, that they can then spin off, and that they have a great difficulty dealing with really what is appears to be, you know, it's just the observations of pretty, you know, common sense things that have led people to conclude that 9/11 was some kind of inside job, and that there's just an absolute wall of silence in terms of getting leaked information that could sort of help us prove that.
Well, yeah, and there's also, you know, there's the nutcases that surround us. There's the problem with, you know, debunkers. Like, there are very few debunkers, like, compared to how many people there are that support the case, say, for the controlled demolition, if we just think about that. And just the other day, I saw this fellow, he's, you know, head of some, you know, scientist for rational thinking. It could be a two-person group, you know, but anyway, it sounded good, and his name's Dave Thomas. I'm not really sure what his background is. I believe he's a physicist at a university, and he was talking with Gage on this Coast to Coast program. You know, I remember I used to listen to Casey Kasem in the top 40 or whatever on Coast to Coast on the same network. But
right.
Anyway, they were having a discussion, you know, over 3 hours with questions and answers about controlled demolition. And the spin that this guy was using about the way the towers collapsed, he was saying, look, we've got this weight and it accelerates at free fall across the floor completely. And then consequently, the weight of the mass increases 20 or 30 times, you know, and he's making this argument and it sort of sounds rational. Oh, okay, you know. And then he talks about the nanothermite, saying, oh, he mentioned it to a chemist in passing, and the chemist said, oh, yeah, of course there's aluminium and there's iron oxide rust and there's this, that, and the other in the building debris. Of course there is. But without even looking at the complexity of the structure of the material, the nanothermite that's been found, we can't make it, you know. And people question the handling of the dust samples, the evidence, the way that it's being controlled and handled, the chain of custody. And they question that just on the basis that it was, you know, 6 years ago that it was collected, and that was 3 years after it happened. And they just throw all this conjecture in there. But the dust is all the same. It has all the same elements. It's the same in every other way that the dust was tested, the official reports we can see. It's got this material in it that only the top labs can make. You know, like,
yeah.
It's just ridiculous that we could have all these samples, and there's more than four samples that are quoted in that paper. There's more like 10, 12, 20 samples, I believe, getting around, you know, of different people who've got, but the chain of custody is not very good, you know, so they only could use the ones that they had this chain of custody for. And the idea that this material's, you know, somehow manufactured from the airplane hitting the building, and the idea that, you know, the tower could just snap all of a sudden and fall directly into the path of greatest resistance and destroy the building to dust. People try to make these things sound reasonable, and they're quite good at it. It's surprising. And journalists just aren't cluey enough about science to know who's right and who's wrong sometimes, I think.
And without a legal process of criminal investigation that would basically start by interviewing witnesses, suspects, and, you know, an inquest, you know, I mean, all
that's
these
right.
things.
We know that the official story is inadmissible, period.
Yeah, yeah. So,
just,
I mean,
it's driven by a tortured testimony, prefabricated storyline, you know, by Bush insiders that we're hell-bent on going to war, you know, and the commissioners said it was, you know, hopeless and they were set up to fail. And, you know, the whole, there's no doubt the official story is completely wrong. Like, it can't even go into a court, but the idea of getting our evidence into a court just seems impossible, because the judges in, or there's one particular judge, I believe, in New York, just won't hear any claims. No one has heard any evidence about 9/11, really, only in some civil matters, you know?
And I think the problem there is the problem started right from day one, when it was asserted without any evidence that it was Osama bin Laden. And from that day one, there was never any process of normal criminal investigation, because it was decided who did it. And of course, if the question of the demolition of the buildings had been looked at from a criminal point of view, then it would have been necessary to subpoena anyone who was involved in the security of the World Trade Center, the security managers, the Otis Elevator Company, basically. That would be a normal process of inquiry, wouldn't it? If it had been acknowledged from the beginning that there must have been some explosives in there, then there would have been a succession of things that would have occurred, and that all any forensic evidence then would have been compounded by having a witness up there. You know, for example, things like that they pulled the dogs, the sniffer dogs, away from the building a few days before. The fact that there were strange, power downs in the building a few days before, and all these things would have been the subject of very intense questioning. But of course, they never were, because it was, those questions were never even answered.
Well,
from
I think for the same reason that you know, you just stated about the events. You know, that once it was decided that Osama bin Laden had carried out these attacks, you know, we know, you know, looking at the history, we know that there was reasons why they wanted to get, you know, at the Taliban and get into Afghanistan geopolitically. There's many reasons. But, you know, anyway, say if we take it that they just made a mistake and they fingered Osama bin Laden and said, right, that's him, we're going to go and bomb a whole sovereign country and kill thousands of people. It's too late. The reality is now that's what it is. And that's sort of the way an empire works. And, you know, they just make a decision and do it. And to question it just means that everyone is complicit in the crime, really. You know, every journalist that hasn't reported the crimes of the 9/11 Commission and the crimes that have been committed against the first responders and the crimes that have been committed in the name of a story that is not testable at all, you know, they're all complicit in this crime. You know, getting on to this latest thing that, you know, you threw out there, this Catherine Taylor project, you know, actually bringing them to account for their ignorance, you know.
Yeah, exactly, and you can see why they have the attitude that they do, why they have this sort of stonewalling attitude. I can understand it from a self-preservation point of view. And, of course, once we the people who are on the other side, like us, we also have to keep going because we can't back off either. You know, it's very hard. You can't sort of reverse the process of becoming a truther. I mean, I've tried. I can't stop. It's a one-way trip, I think. And I think that difficult work of just getting more and more people on that track is what we're engaged in. And it's very, very painful and slow.
Well, it's just, mate, it's like in the modern era of the info war, it's just like you're in the trenches at Gallipoli, eh? You know,
yeah,
10 feet from the Turks. And, you know, and the thing is that you're not really fighting because most of them, the good journalists, know that you got the goods and they can't argue with you because, you know, what you say, there's a lot of evidence proving that everything was being told to lie. And they don't know what happened. You know, they can't figure it out because, like you said, they don't have the sources that they're used to, you know, these investigations, or even though, mostly they're completely flawed, you know, and except for in the case of deaths in disasters, et cetera, we get good findings from people in our country, at least around those sorts of things in this country, but maybe not in America. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, we're in the trenches and we're opposite, you know, in this case, you know, the technocrats or the, you know, sort of the journalist class, or, you know, the people that, you know, really the bread and butter of society as far as getting information around, you know, we're trying to break into that group with our story. It's sort of like we're just in this deadlock because they don't really want to engage with us at all because we make them look foolish every time we do and they feel guilty because they won't look into it further. But on the other hand, you know, they use excuses that we provide either, you know, because we don't know what we're doing, because we're just amateurs, you know, which happens regularly, or because quite often, you know, I think it's because there's people around that are putting out these nutty ideas, you know, or these ideas that aren't based in evidence. Like, it doesn't matter what your theory is, you know. If you can't prove it with any sort of documentation that would stand up in a court, you know, then what are you bothering with it for? What's the point, you know?
That's right, and there's just this, that just keeps circling around. And I mean, I get a lot of emails, I get a lot of people contacting me trying to bring these sort of fringe ideas back up again, and of course, you know, after a time you learn to ignore it, you just want to keep focusing on, and I'm basically getting more confident over time, really. That's what I would say, is I've noticed that I'm just more confident about what I know and about what is worth talking about. And
you've had a few, you know, cricket matches with the Turks in the middle of the killing zone there, haven't you, a few times? Like every now and then, like I went to, you know, dinner with a journalist the other day. they do occasionally, you know, come and, you know, we get some engagement with them. And they're always fascinated, and you know, we can sort of. I think we've just got this, you know, some of us at least have just got so much background knowledge about some of these issues that these people are just, you know, completely out of their depth, you know, on these sorts of issues. But the thing is, like, they just won't expose the simple things. You know, that's all we want them to do.
Absolutely, and you know, that's why we do these shows. That's why you you're doing your show, to basically, you know, these broadcasts are also for the future, because we want to keep a record of the fact that that there were people who were working against the tyranny that's going on at the moment. And I think it will be really important, because I do think in the future, when things get better, hopefully, they'll want to know that there was a real movement. Even if we don't succeed, I mean, it's not a question of whether we succeed or not. We just do it anyway. And like the people who worked against Hitler in the 1930s, you know, they didn't succeed, you know. And a lot of them ended up being executed, and, you know, had a bad fate. But that's so be it.
Well, interest. I mean, you know, interest in these subjects, you know, and fighting these campaigns. You know, people might say, you know, they're useless. But you know, besides, I think there's plenty of evidence that shows that they're not useless. I think we've made plenty of inroads, and I think we've changed public perception in a whole lot of ways. And you know, and I think we've been demonstrating that we can sort of lead what's happening. And I sort of thought that Tony Abbott was going to get elected, unelectable a year ago. I was talking to you about it,
yeah.
Based on the CO2 tax, right?
Yeah.
And really, even though it's not getting talked about, I think that's what basically went down. You know, but I'm not certain of that. But that's sort of what it seems like now, that the Liberal coalition might form a government. But it's hard to say. It's all
I think so.
The community is so confused. The community doesn't know what to believe anymore. And part of that, I think, has got something to do with what we've been doing and other groups have been doing with some of these issues that are so obvious but not talked about. People really don't know who or what to believe anymore. I think they're just fading with their back pocket, and they're just sort of thinking, you know, that I don't want any more tax, or, you know, I'm not really sure what they're thinking. But they're not really thinking about the world as a foreign policy place. You know, it's not really their concern. I get that sense in Australia. It's just confused.
Yeah, and the fact that the election was so evenly divided is, to me, an indication of that. Because, and I could see this coming, and it's partly because people don't feel that either party really answers their needs. A lot of the votes go to the Greens because it's kind of a protest vote, but then those votes flow back to Labor anyway because of the preferential voting system. So this is actually highlighting a flaw in the democracy, the so-called democracy. And there's an excellent article actually by Ted Mack, former independent and former MP and Lord Mayor of North Sydney at one stage. And he wrote a really good article highlighting how the current voting system is actually not really democratic. It's got all these flaws built into it. For example, if you go to vote in the Senate, you've got two choices. You can either vote above the line or below the line. That's on the ballot paper. Now, below the line is this huge maze of people you can vote for by putting a number next to their name. And in the last election, it was 84 numbers you had to put into those boxes. Now, you can exercise your fully democratic right to vote with 84 numbers that have to be consecutively numbered. And if you make a single mistake, your vote is chucked out. So most people vote above the line. A lot of the people who vote below the line, their votes won't be counted anyway. So right there, there's a glaring problem. And of course, with the House of Reps, with the preferential voting system, you know, you vote for the Greens because you think they're what you want, but your vote ends up going to put Labor in. And it's even happened that candidates that have actually had a...
Yeah, well, it doesn't do that in the Senate, and it does do that to an extent, you know, in each electorate. But if you know the status of your electorate, my electorate actually had a swing to Labor and a swing to the Greens, which is a bit unusual. But you know, like I numbered my, you know, ballot ticket the way that I wanted it, you know, in the Senate, you vote above the line because, like you said, the system's just... Who's going to number that? You could, like you said, you can make a mistake and you're there forever. So really, you know, you just pick the party you want. But in the Senate, the way it sort of works, you still get some demonstration of what the overall vote is for a particular party, you know, the way that it works. But the preferences do come into count, I'm pretty sure, when they don't have a total number of votes enough to get another spot in the Senate. Then they introduce the you know, those preferences. But I'm not really sure how that Senate works.
Indeed, indeed.
Because it's pretty fair. The Senate's reasonably fair the way it works. You know, like you vote for someone or, you know, for a particular party, and if that gets enough votes, then they will get a member in the Senate. You know, that's generally how it works. But like you said, in the preferences in the lower house, people follow the how to vote cards, and that's how they get, you know, loaded up with preferences, or they just vote for one and the preferences automatically go across, I suppose.
Yeah, and then, of course, we have really high-profile campaigns from GetUp, for example, which purports to be a totally grassroots, non-political organisation, and you, they give you, but they have representatives at all of the polling booths, and I mean, I was approached by a person from GetUp, and they had a, you know, a how to vote card. I mean, and every box for green was ticked, so it was basically an indication of, you know, which important issues are well represented by which parties, and so you have this grid of boxes, and so there's a tick when it basically a particular policy is well represented. Well, in the leaflet that GetUp was giving out, all of the boxes in the Green Party were ticked, so it was clearly a how to vote card from GetUp promoting the Greens. I mean, and GetUp as an organisation is supposed to be just basically a human rights and justice organisation, but I've come to the conclusion after, you know, studying it for a while, that it really is a party political apparatus, and a lot of people that I spoke to at the polling booth were aware of that as well. I had a bit of a joke about it, and I have a few chuckles from the crowd.
Was it busy where you were voting in the city?
Well, I was actually down in Canberra, and I had to vote absentee. Okay. Actually, the way it was organised down there was so messy. I went to one place to vote, and I stood in a queue for about 20 minutes. I got to the front of the queue, and they told me I couldn't vote there. You know, I had to go to some other voting centre. So then I had to stand in another queue, and it was pretty crowded. There were a lot of long queues, I have to say. Yeah.
Okay. Now the way our suburb works, it's just like clockwork. It's really easy.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
But it's been the same way for a long while, and I don't know, they've just got it all worked out. Yeah, no, it's good. It's no problem. When I was voting, I was thinking about being a black poor person in America in some places, some districts, you know, where they, you know, the election's called on a weekday, and so they've got to take a day off work or whatever they've got to do to get there, and then have to wait 6 or 7 hours to vote, you know.
That is incredible.
My God. I just walked in, I'd voted and out the door in 5 minutes, you know, so, you know, on a nice weekend, you know, when there's time to do it. So, yeah, we are very lucky here. And at least the politicians are arguing about doing the right thing by us, you know. It's sort of like American politics is so much worse, I think, in so many ways.
True, yeah. I mean, we do have an advantage here. Like, we're ahead in a lot of ways. And that's why, you know, we're more aware of some of the problems that are coming down the line. And so I really think what we do in Australia is actually really significant. But look, I'm just going to take a short break, John, and when we get back, I want to move on with some other stories for tonight.
Yep, so, no worries.
Just hang on there. Here's a song by Jose Gonzalez. It's called Slow Moves. Intentions revealing all.
so you know.
Well, moving along, as we mentioned there earlier, we do have the 9/11 protest scheduled for the 11th of September at the War Memorial in Sydney in Hyde Park. So if you're able to get to that, it would be excellent. I seem to have some music coming here on my... Is that coming from your end, John, or is it coming from mine?
Sorry, mate, I just got the mobile. I just got to turn it off.
No, you're right. Anyway, as I was saying, we've got the 9/11 protest scheduled for 11 September at 11 a.m. outside the War Memorial in Hyde Park. If you're in Sydney, please try to get to that. Be an interesting day. Now, I'd like to just move on with some other stories. John, you mentioned we've talked a lot about problems with the intervention and Aboriginal rights on the show on and off. And I actually would like to do some whole shows on it. I'm really concerned about the way in which basically a new type of racism is, it's kind of a resurfacing of racism in Australia. And with the policies of the government as well, with the intervention, we're seeing kids being taken away from their families, again, at a really alarming rate. We're seeing totally humiliating practices like the welfare quarantining. And we're seeing the police getting away with some quite outrageous crimes against humanity and not even leading to criminal convictions in some cases. I don't know if you'd just like to maybe pick up on that.
It so happens that, you know, I do have an Indigenous background, and my father's been heavily involved in Indigenous issues over the last, 10 years or so in a serious way. And recently I had a friend that was a good friend of my brother's that came and stayed with us in Sydney only a year or so ago, and his name was Donnie Ryder. And he was a stockman. He was training to be a ranger up there. He had a house with another friend of ours, Jade Keel. And they were, he was out one night and came home and they had a fight, but he went out for a walk on the river, and it was quite early in the hours of the morning. And there was these hoons, dashing through there and there. In their pickup truck, we could sort of say that because it's sort of like the deep south, Anyway, in their four-wheel drive ute. And, they were, terrorising these campers, and they sort of did it over a period of hours. And, and because the Aboriginal people are sort of so oppressed, they don't sort of call the police about these things. They just swallow it, They swallow all sorts of things up there I wasn't aware of. So they just sort of put up with that, and they might, one of the ladies threw a log at the car and, you know, and they'll have a go. Like they're not scared of a fight, one-on-one or whatever. But as far as dealing with the police, they just don't seem to want to do it. So this went on for a few hours, and then my friend Donnie was walking down the road. He'd seen this, right, and he knew what was going on. And, you know, these hoons came back out of the river, and he threw a bottle at the car. And anyway, they turned around and they kicked him to death on the, you know, just there until he didn't move, and then they panicked and fled, you know. But they, you know, it's four of them actually involved in the killing. But the crazy thing that really makes you wonder what's going on up there is there seems to be some sort of dehumanization happening with the perspective of the you know, non-Indigenous people that live there. It's like the Aboriginals supply most of their economy, but they're treated like they're a non-entity in a way, because the council, the first thing they were talking about was getting, you know, those Aboriginals out of the river, you know, rather than dealing with the fact that they'd had a racist group of young boys, you know, rocking around in their car terrorizing these
really?
People. Actually run over the swag of one old fella, like this very old guy.
Yeah.
He had to crawl out of his swag or got run over, you know. So
my God.
You know, and they're drunk. And anyway, so, you know, they kick Donnie, you know, in the head numerous times. They break a bottle over the back of his head. Okay, and then you know, and then they take off like cowards and hide and create alibis when they find out he's dead, and they lie to the police. They do everything wrong.
And were any of these guys injured? Were they actually attacked? Were they injured?
No, not at all. No, they just were in the car, and he threw the bottle at the car as they went past, knowing what they'd been doing.
Yeah.
And they just came back, and this was like 6 a.m, and just kicked him to death. Now, there was, in the autopsy, was found a possibility that he had an aneurysm at the base of his brain.
Right.
Which is like a sack of, you know, blood, I think.
Oh, okay.
Not sure exactly what it is, but that's what I imagine it is. And it had burst, and this has caused some of the pressure that had killed him. But that was only a possibility. That wasn't confirmed. But anyway, these you know, so the council wanted to get the Aboriginals out of the creek so the boys wouldn't harass them, you know, and because these good, you know, white boys are just having a bit of hooning around, not doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
And then another thing that happened was when they get to court, you know, they changed the charge to manslaughter, you know.
That's incredible.
And these guys get off, you know, 4 years, and one of them gets off with 1 year. He's out now. You know, he just sat in the back of the car while his mates, you know, kicked this poor fellow to death, you know.
So when did this event happen?
It was about a year ago, yeah.
A year ago, okay.
Now, anyway, it'll probably be talked about at this event that's coming up. But just so happened I was talking to a journalist that's done a very good story on Donnie Ryder. Now, he's got an Aboriginal name that I can't pronounce very well, so I won't try. But
sure.
You might find it under another name. But if you search Donnie Ryder, you'll find the story. It was the full Four Corners episode was done on it about a month ago. And they did quite a good job in exposing the racism, but they, from what I hear from the inside of the ABC, they wish they had have gone harder, because they sort of didn't go hard enough.
Okay.
And that's what, there's this event coming up that's actually looking at the fact that Lateline hasn't been doing its job, and other media have really been failing in exposing the NT intervention, you know, which is considered to be, you know, a racist policy by the UN and many other bodies around the world, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the simple facts are that in the same socioeconomic environment, Aboriginal people behave just the same as any white people, as any other people. It's just that they have such a bad socioeconomic situation, you know, because of, you know, basically because we destroyed their culture, you know, and everything changed for them, and they haven't really been able to adjust. You know, that's the real story of Aboriginal people, is that, you know, they're lost, you know, because they're between two worlds, and they've been abused and broken, their family's been broken up, and, you know, they've been given, you know, alcohol, which is, you know, and they've already got low self-esteem because of their situation and all the rest of it, and they, you know, weren't getting paid properly till just a few years ago. Many of them owed many thousands of dollars, and, you know, have been traumatized by all sorts of things. So, you know, really, we should be caring about these people, but rather than doing that, we're treating them like animals. That seems to be the case, and the media is not doing the job.
And yet it's being played. It's being fed back to us that this intervention is actually about helping people. And even there are even some Aboriginal leaders who've gone along with that view. And that's what I see as being extremely sad, is that
Noel Pearson supported it somewhat. I think, I'm not sure what his view is these days, but you know, I've met Noel Pearson, and he's a nice enough fellow, and he's trying to deal with the reality of the situation, you know. So he sees it as, you know, very dark, and there is very dark things there, but it's the approach. It's this approach that because you're this, we're going to do this, you know. And yeah. It's just, that's not how life is. And, you know, we can't just say, okay, there are Aboriginal people living here, so we're going to take, you know, all their rights away, and we're going to treat them like animals. It's just not on. You know, it's just period. It's, you know, so and it's all about respect and about, you know, I don't know. John Howard wasn't real big on that, was he?
He wasn't, you know. And of course, but it highlights the fact that we don't really have an alternative government, because when the Rudd government came in, they didn't alter it one bit. And in fact, not only did they not alter it, one of the first things that I remember Julia Gillard saying, I remember this because I didn't really know who she was at the time, but I heard this woman, Julia Gillard, talking about how they wanted to roll out the welfare quarantining system nationwide. And I was just staggered by that, because, I mean, I'd thought that Labor kind of represented values that I fundamentally agree with. You know, I thought, well, you know, often they stray off in different areas, but they surely wouldn't want to impose a really fascist type system onto the entire population. But that's exactly what they intend to do, and they have been rolling it out. I mean, the welfare quarantining, and I'll just explain what that is. If you're receiving certain types of benefits from the government, I think it's unemployment and a few other things, you will a lot of your money will actually be put aside in a special account that you can't access directly. You can only access it through a special card, and only by buying goods at designated stores. And that those are often like Coles or 7-Eleven. And I mean, apart from the horrible commercial monopolistic aspects of that, the corporatist monopolistic aspects of that, which are just absolutely bone-chilling, really, when you think about it. The fact is that it's turning you, it's putting you in the position of an enslavement, basically denying the core freedom that you have when you can basically, you know, get a government benefit because you're obviously unable to get work or you have some disability. You know, and the benefit was there to allow you to live. But now they want to say, well, no, you can live the way we choose. You can buy what we let you buy. And somehow this mentality, it's just so anathema to freedom. It's so anathema to democracy, has just crept in. But incrementally, it's still at a low level. But they've said, and their intention is to roll this out.
Well, it's interesting. Anyway, let's just get back to the point in case this event that you mentioned, which is coming up. It's called Racism in the Media.
Indeed.
The Lies Behind the NT Intervention. Now, you can, at the moment, I've only got a Facebook place to find this, but I'm sure if you searched it, you'll find it on the web. But, you know, we'll find it and get it on the show notes. But anyway, it's on September 3rd, so it's only coming up in just a week or so. And it's at the UTS University Hall. We've been there before for a few things here and there.
Excellent.
So that's on the, you know, just off, it's actually off Harris Street. So it's actually opposite the ABC. But anyway, now the lies of this that led to the intervention was basically set up by the ABC, it seems, from what I've read on the notes about what this is going to be about. And the presentation is by Chris Graham, but he's got quite a few other important people there, and also a former senior policy advisor of the Community Engagement and Recovery at the Office of Indigenous Policy Coordination under Mal Brough. So anyway, there's a few interesting people there, and basically it's going to expose that Late Line and other ABC journalism, as we saw with Chappelle Corby and with 9/11 and with the War on Terror and all the other shit that we know that they've got wrong.
Yeah.
You know, basically they've gone into bat for something that's based on lies.
That is really important. Okay, we'll put those all that information up. I'll definitely try to make it to that September 3rd.
Yeah, I'm going to go along, so I'm quite looking forward to it. And this Chris Graham guy, you know, I got talking to him the other day, and that's how I found out about this. You know, I talked to him about some of the 9/11 issues. He doesn't have a view, but he understands, you know, he's definitely of the camp that they used it to, you know, maximum advantage. And, you know, he didn't say so, but I had a feeling that he thought that, you know, there were many failures, you know, that maybe they did let it happen, but that's not his position on it. But he was open to it, and he actually admitted that he was ignorant, and he probably shouldn't be so ignorant of such an important issue. But many of these walkie award-winning journalists are ignorant of these issues, but there's not many that are actually prepared to say they are. So, you know, I sort of have a real trust for this guy, and I think he's actually known as bulletproof in the business. Like, when he puts something out there, it's very well checked and researched. You know, he's a very sure. careful journalist.
Yeah.
So I think what this presentation will give us is an unbiased view of the situation. But he definitely has this view that there is rampant racism in Alice Springs, for a start, and quite a few other places in Australia.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it's definitely something to look out for.
But this is more about, obviously, the media behind the intervention. And at the time, it's just like when we went into Iraq, the ABC had me believing that it was a good idea.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, they do
and
a great job of
it. That's disgusting. It makes me feel full sick, you know, and something like crawling under my skin when I think about that, you know, because that's what they did. You know, they're warmongers. That's been proven before. And in this case, they're supporting racism by the looks of it, just with their ignorance.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, John, there's just another story I want to cover while I've got you on the line here. So just hang on while I get that up. Now, John, you've done your fair share of research into the Kennedy assassination. I know it's something you find quite interesting. And I have too. I kind of grew up with it because my father was a Kennedy conspiracy theorist from the beginning. He watched it all on television unfolding in 1963, and he talked about it. He never stopped talking about it till the day he died. He knew that that he'd been lied to, and one of the things that he was most certain about was that Oswald was deliberately assassinated by the police. And you know, he reckoned he could tell that just from the way the police behaved when Jack Ruby walked up and shot him, that the police basically just hardly flinched. They just kind of held Oswald there in a vice-like grip while Jack Ruby ran up and plugged a bullet straight into his stomach. I think the Kennedy assassination is also really important for the 9/11 truth movement, because it gives us another example of one of these conspiracies that has been supposedly completely covered up. You know, they always talk about, you know, where is the whistleblower? You know, how could they keep a secret? And this is what they say about 9/11. And this is what they've said about the Kennedy assassination. But of course, you look back and you find, well, there were a lot of people who mysteriously died, who had evidence that didn't correspond with the official view.
Well, they're supposed to be literally hundreds of people around the Kennedy assassination that have died before their time.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a long list of it. I mean, and I, you know, I obviously can't confirm all of that, but I know that there are some very significant ones, like the operating pathologist who actually had conflicting information, because there were two different people who did the autopsy. There was one guy they brought in initially, then he was whisked out, and then they brought in another a military guy, I think.
Well,
of course,
the body
autopsy
should have never been moved from Dallas. You know, it was supposed to stay there and in the care of the police where the murder occurred. And, you know, they had their regular forensic fellow to do the autopsy there, and you're very experienced, you know. And obviously, the autopsy ended up being done by this naval doctor that had never done an autopsy on a human before. And,
Indeed,
in the meantime, the body was tampered with and damaged. Like, consequently, to get back to the point, is that the JFK assassination, it's bloody big, and it demonstrates that, you know, the systems of government are not really that powerful or important in the scheme of things. You know, it's sort of like you can see the government as the outside of the body, but really the workings of the body are obviously, you know, not represented by what we're seeing, you know. And I think you saw that, you know, the people like the CIA, which are this organization for overseas intelligence gathering, you know, predominantly, and for activities promoting America, you know, whatever you want to call it, murder, rape and pillage.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, the CIA are out there, and they have these people that are part of their group throughout all these other organizations. And we have these other groups of business people that meet, and, you know, and the CFR and all these other things. And this shadow government, you know, is where the action is, you know, and this is what Peter Dale Scott talks about, and it's really the people that keep coming in and out of power, you know, they're there all the time, and that's where this incompetency, you know, theory and this, you know, they can't keep it secret and all the rest of it, it just becomes ridiculous when you actually look at the way things work. You know, they're two steps ahead all the time in the way they're playing the game. You know, they're doing something, they destroyed Iraq on purpose.
And there's so much compartmentalization.
No, Rumsfeld's
so much...
not an idiot. You know, he's not an idiot. You know, he was Secretary of Defense when he was 40 or something, you know?
Yeah.
And this guy's like got a big brain on him, you know? He's a criminal.
Yeah.
But, you know, to think that he went into Iraq and destroyed all the infrastructure so that he could have a bad time there and it'd take a long time to get out, it's just ridiculous to think that. That's not the case. He did it on purpose, you know?
That's...
And just like Kennedy was killed on purpose by, you know... numerous killing teams, and it was done in a military-style operation. You know, there's no doubt about it. Anyone that's rational that looks at the evidence sees that, and there have been many whistleblowers, just like 9/11, but they just don't get heard, you know, and people die. And
that's right. Well, you know, and on that note, there is another whistleblower who has emerged recently, and there's a story about it, which I've got up here, was on Fox News, believe it or not.
Fox often get this sort of stuff out there, don't they?
They do. It's bizarre, isn't it? Fox has covered most of the 9/11 breaking stories and 9/11 truth movement.
The people that watch Fox, I think it just sort of sends a message to them. You know, we're powerful, so just stay out of it.
Possibly,
I think
yeah.
That's why they put that out there every now and then. It's just because, you know, all the people that are listening or watching Fox aren't really that, you know, I shouldn't say too much, but you know, they're not the most driven people as far as political things go, you know, actual action. You know, there are some sections of the Fox audience that are on the right wing, I suppose, that are able to get out there and do things. But mostly, you know, they're being entertained, you know. Sometimes I wonder why they put stuff like this up. But it probably does scare them a little bit because I think a lot of people know there's something going on, you know.
Yeah, and every now and then, you know, a real whistleblower does step forward and... I'm still slightly mystified as to why Fox does cover this when in fact it should be on something like Democracy Now or at least, you know, some more mainstream alternative news. But no,
conspiracy theory.
Yeah, indeed.
Can't touch that. You know?
Indeed. So look, I'll just play you this clip and see what you make of it. I think there's going to be an ad at the beginning. Sorry about that. Nothing I can do about that. We'll just play it and see what we get.
No problem.
November 22nd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy is gunned down in Dallas. Officially, Lee Harvey Oswald fired the fatal shots from the Texas Book Depository. But now, a local man's got history in the crosshairs.
Did Lee Harvey Oswald kill President John F. Kennedy?
No. Had nothing to do with it.
Former FBI agent Don Adams from Summit County says thousands of national archives prove
the Warren Commission was nothing but a bunch of liars.
The Korean War veteran entered the FBI September 1962. He was assigned to Thomasville, Georgia, where he began investigating a man named Joseph Adams Miltier.
He was reported to be one of the most violent men in the country.
A friend of Miltier's, William Somerset, who was also an FBI informant, said Miltier was threatening JFK.
And Somerset was telling them that he was really radical and he was saying bad things about what they wanted to do to Kennedy.
Agent Adams completed the Miltier investigation, and a week later, shots rang out in Dallas.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade group.
It devastated me, and I thought to myself, what did I do wrong?
His boss said, find Miltier.
I said goodbye to my partner. He never said a word to me about anything about Miltier that he knew him or anything.
Many years later, Don learned that agents contacted his partner, who told them Miltier was in Georgia, essentially eliminating him as a suspect.
And that shocked me when I saw that document because I knew it was an outright lie.
Then, when Adams finally captured Miltier days later, he says his supervisor prohibited him from conducting a proper interrogation. Miltier was released and Agent Adams transferred.
And where did I go but to Dallas, Texas?
He remembers seeing the Zapruder film for the very first time.
And all of a sudden I saw the president go like this with his hands. And I said, Hal, I said, he was shot in the throat. The minute that you have a frontal shot, Oswald can't be the shooter because this came from the grassy knoll. And Oswald was in Texas School Book Depository.
The Warren Commission said 3 shots were fired, but Don counted 11.
The agent said to me, Don, be careful what you say and how you say it, because the Warren Commission is here, and they've already ruled that Oswald is the shooter, and there were no shots from the front.
The Army veteran wondered how Oswald fired 3 shots in 7.5 seconds from a bolt-action rifle.
I'm going to tell you something right now, guys. There's no way in the world Oswald shot that weapon. And boy, I mean, I was really cautioned then.
Don eventually retired from the FBI, never thinking twice about Miltier, until 1992, when he saw a picture in this book, which he says positively places Miltier in Dallas the day of the shooting.
Joseph Adams Miltier, looking at the presidential car moments before the president was killed.
At the National Archives and Records Administration, Don found many reports missing or manipulated, including his file on Miltier from 63.
Everything that I had done was gone. Everything was gone.
But the most startling discovery was a tape recording captured by Miami intelligence officers November 9, 1963, just weeks before Dallas. Miltier is talking to the informant, William Somerset. The FBI headquarters and Secret Service both had that tape within days.
It should have stopped the president from traveling instantly.
But they didn't.
And he says he was jubilant.
Bragging to Somerset, you thought I was kidding when I said he would be killed from a window with a high-powered rifle. Despite all of that, Miltier was never even mentioned in the Warren Commission report.
When Hoover set up the propaganda in the FBI, don't embarrass the FBI. That was his rules. And you didn't. So they ordered everything put into the archives and to be forgotten about it.
But Don can't forget and hopes something is done before the truth is buried forever.
I mean, when we die off, when we're gone, there's not going to be anybody who's going to sit here and tell you these things. I hope the truth gets told, whatever it is.
In Summit County, Suzanne Stratford, Fox 8 News.
Okay, there we have it. A lot of different pieces of information were brought up in that piece. It was kind of really a compilation of things. The most important of which really being stuff that we already knew about Kennedy, the difficulty of getting the 3 shots off, the whole number of things there that, you know, basically this is just a guy who's an FBI agent that that has a common sense view, and that extra information about Miltier may or may not be significant. Quite often
Known something about, you know, they just had a whole lot of people, that were second and third, removed from things that were going on. They were just shutting down the investigation completely. So, but who knows? Yeah, I don't know. He said that he was a pretty bad bloke. Interesting that the fellow, all the things that he said were the same sort of conclusions I'd come to. Everything he was saying seemed correct from the way I see things. So as far as what actually went down, the 11 shots, that's the most reasonable number of shots, I think, that we've seen. Some people have said 12 or
right.
more, but most of the evidence, I think it's around 11 shots. And obviously, not only, it was he firing with a rifle that wasn't sighted well, and he couldn't get the shots off that fast with the bolt-action rifle. He also was a right-hander and firing out of that window. If you think about the scene, to get the rifle out the window with him firing it, he actually has to rotate over so that his head's below the weapon, or he has to fire left-handed.
Just so many improbabilities and difficulties
that's
there.
That alone, that's it. That's finished. You don't have to get past the official story is completely flawed in every regard, and it's amazing that the American people swallowed it. And I mean, that's why a lot of people probably never bothered with 9/11 truth,
And of course, and they were stuck with that story because they had to pin it on Oswald, and they couldn't have had Oswald firing more than 3 shots because that would have been completely impossible. So once they said it was Oswald, and they said that there were 3 shots, that there is a degree of incompetence in the cover up Because also the type of weapon used was changed from the beginning when they said it was a Mannlicher Kakano, and then they said it was a Mauser, or I forget which way around it was, but anyway, the type of weapon used was changed. And of course, the biggest problem being the way Kennedy's head moves when he's shot clearly indicates that that he was shot from the front.
Yeah, there was things that went down wrong, like that. It's just like 9/11 too, with Building 7 and other things. That I believe that the shooter that was shooting from the front, you know, from the grassy knoll, he was the one that had the best shot, but they were sort of hoping that he wouldn't be needed.
Possibly, yeah.
Now, I'm pretty sure there was someone shooting from the building. That seems to be the case on the floor below where Oswald was, or in the vicinity. There was someone that shot from that location, but most likely, with a killing team like that, they'd have three positions, you'd think. And the best way to shoot a moving person in a vehicle is as the vehicle is approaching you, you know, at a slightly oblique angle. You know, that's the best way. You know, you can see them clearly. Also, they're travelling towards you, so you know you don't have that problem with them traversing you too quickly, which makes it more difficult to get the shot
with that sharp turn, because he was shot at that sharp turn there where it meant that the car had to slow down.
But he's coming straight towards the grassy knoll, and he comes sort of coming at it at an oblique angle and then goes across the front of it. But it was quite an easy shot from that position, and that was I don't think they planned to have to shoot from there. It was like the backup in case he was only injured, you know, so because it's still hard to hit someone in a moving vehicle.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems most
slowed down a lot. The driver nearly came to a complete stop until he saw the headshot. You know, and it's because he was watching. And you know, I've seen people break down that video, and it seems pretty clear that the driver was part of the plan, and he was to slow right down into the killing zone. You know, which was decided to be that short run of highway down past the grassy knoll was where it was all going to happen. You know,
that's right. And like the best explanation I've heard is that there were probably at least three shooters, so that there was a triangulation going on.
And not just shooters, teams, because they've got to have a spotter.
Right, yeah.
They have someone that's spotting and also that's watching to make sure no one's going to stop them, you know.
You know, yeah, and so yeah,
two or three people in each group, yeah. So
the cover-up was poor, but one thing was certain is they were going to kill Kennedy.
And they didn't care. You know.
Yeah.
They didn't really even care if they got caught, I don't think. They were just going to spin it and cover it up however they had to. And if a few people got caught, or, you know, that was just going to be it. But they seemed to have it pretty well wrapped up immediately, didn't they?
Yeah, they certainly did. I mean, the control of the media, of course, is the other side of it that's the most chilling about it, is the way the media just in a coordinated fashion started announcing Oswald as the killer within hours. And of course, on the other side of the world, in New Zealand, they published the story of Oswald as the killer before Oswald had even been arrested.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a it's quite well documented that the Christchurch Herald had publicised Oswald as the killer before Oswald, certainly before Oswald was charged, but it was well ahead of any other publications, and it appears that that they got fed the story early. And because of the time difference and stuff, they published it before they should have. It's reminiscent of the BBC announcing Building 7 going down before it went down. It's the same type of situation when you've got events happening on the other side of the world, and you've got the news being fed to a news organisation in advance. Of course, that sort of thing, it's a real clear indicator. You know, it's a real red warning, you know, flag of what was going on there. I think it's really important, and you know, just the way in which the media is always sort of coordinated to basically give you one particular view of these issues really needs to be looked at.
Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, mostly it's just, once again, it's around, it's such a big event and everybody's so traumatized, and you know, no one wants to think that there's, you know, a government plot to kill the president of the United States. That's not very good for stability. That's not good for the dollar. It's not good for business. You know, like, everyone's just always thinking about what's good for them, you know? And
that's correct. Yeah, yeah.
And I just sort of think that's what goes down, you know? Just humans are pretty fundamentally flawed, you know? We really do need, you know, robust editors in these newspapers and these television stations that are prepared to, you know, call things the way they are, not the way that, you know, everybody thinks they are, because I don't know, we're just never really going to improve. I can't really see how civilization's improved at all over the last few years. I think we're still going backwards. But, you know, this 9/11 truth thing and some of these other big issues that have got out there around journalism and around the mainstream media have definitely put this undercurrent of a deeper understanding of deep politics throughout, you know, the community. So I think that's a good thing. But still, absolutely, not many people seem to want to do anything about it. So, you know.
I mean, I also see some hope in that there are some large news organizations like Russia Today and Press TV from Iran that even though they've got their own agendas, and I certainly wouldn't 100% trust them, that because
they've
got
their own content.
No, no.
I wouldn't trust them on any of their own content.
Indeed,
but
indeed.
To watch for international content.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, because they've got the resources of a nation state behind them, that they're able to give us quite interesting, you know, information in a well presented way.
Yeah, I think RT America works on a pretty low budget. The way they do a lot of their interviews is with you know, webcam type setups. Now, I'm not sure exactly how they do that, whether they provide that for the person or if they send someone out. But they're not too worried about, you know, they're not sending a lighting guy, two cameramen, and a reporter out to interview people. You know, they do it.
I've noticed
they do
that
it in a low budget way. You know, I think they're doing very smart, but their presentations and their research is quite strong, and their presenters are first class. You know.
Oh, they certainly are. Yeah, no, they must. There's a lot of funding, a lot of money going into that. I don't know whether
but not as much as what, you know, someone like you know, I suppose Fox or someone would be spending for the similar sort of thing.
Yeah, I imagine it'd be a lot less. Yeah, you're quite right.
They're doing it in a cheap way, but they've got so much interesting because they can report on things that no one else is reporting on. They can present such interesting news information, so it's really good. I mean, that's the only news I watch regularly now is RT America.
That's great. Do you actually just watch it off YouTube, or do you?
I just get the YouTube update. And just watch sort of the highlights. I mean, I watch other news, but that's, I always like to check through what RT's had on because they always have interesting things. So,
yeah, excellent. Yeah, I mean, I'd say comparing that to the ABC's recently released ABC 24. To me, that's actually one of the shallowest news shows I've ever seen. I started watching it when it first came out.
And it's like Sky News, isn't it?
Yeah, Sky News, but it's kind of Sky News light. I mean, it's really light.
Yeah, Sky News light.
They do a lot of just puff pieces and a lot of light comedy, and I don't know what the hell it is. It's not red. They're calling it a news channel, but it's just infotainment. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, there's a bit of BBC stuff there, and
yeah,
you know, it's okay. It's still better than what we've got anywhere else, but it's it's nothing, nowhere near as interesting as RT, that's for sure.
Yeah,
but right. They only broadcast, I think RT America only broadcasts for 6 hours a day or something.
Right. Okay. Well,
Sure. Not sure exactly. It's not like a full. It's not a full sort of network or anything, but I think, you know, Russia Today in Russia and Europe is supposed to be massive. So, you know, I think they've got 200 million people listen to some of their programs. You know, so it's pretty big. But I think the RT America is pretty fledgling, you know.
Right. Excellent.
But it's very popular out there on the net.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, people are fascinated. You know, people want information. I mean, there's a huge demand for it. I mean, I think news is a real growing area. And what one of the things that's coming, I think, is a new surge in media. You know, we used to call it alternative media. I don't think we even need to use that word anymore. I just think that the old dinosaur media is now just being overtaken, and it's going to happen at an increasingly rapid pace because organizations like News Limited have decided to put all their content behind paywalls, and all that's going to do is drive people more to the alternative options that are out there. And I really don't quite understand the decisions that were made there from Rupert Murdoch and people like that, because they seem to think that they're going to make some more money out of doing this. But most of the people in the industry seem to think that it's going to be the opposite. It's actually going to be a nail in their coffin.
Oh, I'd say so, yeah. Yeah, I don't see how that's going to work. Anyway, dude, I suppose I should get moving on, but I just thought I'd put a plug in for a DVD that's out there that I think everyone in Australia should own if you're a truther, because, you know, it should make you proud that we put this on. That's Stephen Jones' Science and Society, 9/11 Science and Society, which is available at 911tv.org. it's from the States, but, you know, it doesn't cost a lot to send it out. And, you know, you help those guys out. They're the number one film crew. They're the ones that have bought us, Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and all the other great DVD resources we have. So you should support those guys. Ken and Amook are good friends of both Herowood and myself.
Great.
Anyway,
yeah,
you get that
excellent.
That film. Have you watched that film?
No, I haven't. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it's just the best of Stephen Jones, and it's done in Australia, and the Australians on the camera, and it's a great job. Like, I'm very proud that we produced that, and it cost, I'd hate to think how much it actually cost to produce if you just had to do that, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of money, and it'd be good to see it get out there and people enjoy it. I know the people that have watched it said it's great, so, you know, it's the history of the science of 9/11 truth, so it's really, really good.
Excellent. Thanks for that. We'll put that on the show notes. I'll definitely get a link up to that.
Oh, great.
Yeah, great.
Okay, well, thanks. It's been a
great thanks,
pleasure,
John.
And I'm so glad that you're still doing your thing. And we'll keep on plugging forward. We've got to resist, mate.
Yeah, we'll just keep soldiering on.
We took the red pill and we built the rod for our own back. But anyway, we'll see you out,
eh? We have indeed. Okay, talk to you soon again.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Bye.
Well, that's our show for tonight. I hope you enjoyed that. Just a bit of a ramble through some news, some really interesting stuff there I thought we were chatting about. Any ideas, any thoughts, any comments, please contact us. Please follow our tweets and please stay tuned for our next broadcast, which will be in a week's time. Over and out from Truth News Radio Australia.